I've been asked to talk about. About not having the slightest idea. The Japanese expression for that, of course, is how to attain a no mind. Talking about two things which are really the same thing. How to gain personal integration and what is knowledge. Now the scholars in the past have split the examination of knowledge into three parts. One called ontological, that's concerned with the things that you sense. One, logical, that is concerned with the thoughts that you have about the things, or the thinks of the things. And the other, humorously, they call moral. The ontological, the logical, and the moral aspect of knowledge. Moral means how to keep the walls up in any system whatever, including an individual human being. It's a good word if you remember that it means that. It means that which enables one to hold oneself together. Now, if I place, as we usually do, something on the fingers for mnemonic purposes, I will place the thing, that is the ontological aspect of knowledge, on my little finger, because things generally, in a very vast universe, are quite small. So the thing on the little finger, that's the ontological aspect. Now, the logical aspect is normally placed on the index finger, because the index finger points out what it is, what thing it is that we're talking about. So we're going to find a very peculiar mudra here to show the relation between them. I put my index finger against my little finger, and that is thinking about things. The thing thought about is on my little finger. The think that I have about it is on my index finger. And when I do that, I feel rather awkward. Would you like to do a mudra and put your index finger against your little finger and tell me if you feel normal? You aren't walking about shopping like this. Okay. It feels to me this is something missing. But we had a third thing, which is called the moral. Where would we put the moral? Well, we've got two fingers here. Can we call one of those the moral? The thumb. The thumb means the will, doesn't it? Yes. Well, is the will the moral? No? Well, we're going to find that for some mysterious reason, which I personally suspect is quite deliberate, the analysis of what constitutes knowledge has been deliberately deprived of something. If we take the five and say, okay, we'll keep those two, the little finger for the thing we're talking about, the index finger for the think about it, and we've got two fingers between, I'm going to say that the ring finger shall correspond with the act upon the thing. The act upon the thing. And you pointed out, Greta, the thumb, the will. The will to act upon the thing would be those three. Yeah? And it leaves the middle one unaccounted for. I'm going to put the word on the middle finger, because the word is the mediator. So on the middle finger, the word is the sound symbol that you use in an act of will to signify a thing upon which you intend to act in some manner formally to change the situation. So instead of having a simple threefold division which ignores the will and mysteriously the word, we then have five: a will to think of a word to control an action on the body. A will to think of a word to control an action upon the body. Now let's see why the will and the word were kept as sacred religious concepts. For some reason, which if we examine, we shall discover has to do with power, it was decided not to expose, not to advertise these two mysterious something or others, one of which is will, which is initiative, the ability to start something from scratch without a stimulus, and the other one is the word. Now the Gospel of John begins with the word, in the beginning was the word, and the book of Genesis begins with, and God said. Because God said there was light implies the use of a word, namely the word, in that case, light. The same concept of light always signified to the ancients, and especially to the priests and kings, understanding, comprehension, seeing reality as it is. The fourth gospel has in the beginning was the word. So if it's in the beginning, we'll make an animal out of it, like this. You can imagine a plane, and we walk the animal over the plane, and we lead with the word. Now at the moment I'm talking in terms of words, and something is happening in your minds, I hope, correspondent with the word. If it isn't, that's okay, we respect freedom. But if it does, it will be the word that is leading, and so we'll make this animal led by the word. The Greek word for word in that fourth gospel is logos, and logos means ratio and dialectical structures, because it's composed of lambda and gamma. And if you remember, lambda means light equals intelligence, and gamma means the content of that intelligence. As if you were to say, there is an absolute subject, pure consciousness, S, and something inside that subject we call the predicate, that which can rationally be said to be implied in the subject. So we can write an equation, S equals P to the nth. That is, the subject is predication extended a number of times, but no matter how many, we have to posit at the end, S, the subject, is infinite intelligent power, so we have to say plus S. In other words, when we're talking, that is predicating, and that is rationally saying something about a subject, we cannot actually exhaust the subject. Why not? Because when we predicate, when we say something rationally, we abstract from total reality. If I say, that's my friend Trevor over there, Trevor is a portion of reality. And if I say, my friend Gerhard is a portion of reality also, we're predicating by abstracting. Here we have a large number of people. I selected Mr. Butler a little earlier, and uttering his name, remember, to voice is to invoke, call into my mind, where's that fellow who knows all about things electrical when they go wrong? Then, by means of those words, I predicate on the whole subject of infinity that it contains one particular element called Mr. Butler, and another, and another, and I can name all these people here, and even perhaps name myself as a part of the whole reality. So we put our animal in this manner, and the word is the leader. Now, it doesn't matter how intelligent we are, it doesn't matter how sensitive we are, it doesn't matter how many things we encounter in the universe, it doesn't matter how much will we have to interfere with those things, it doesn't matter what is the form that we perceive in those things, it doesn't matter what we do with those things, unless we have a word to name those things and their parts, we cannot control them. And we cannot control ourselves in relation to things that we cannot control. I saw a drawing and a couple of paintings recently of Goethe's, and those showed a remarkable leap forward from some others done a few months ago, because she had actually used some words to define certain aspects of reality for which she should look. She had to look for vectors, for lines which are directed. She had to see certain aspects of reality in a certain way, and the only way she could see them was by means of a word that tuned her perceptive organism, her eyes, her ears and so on, tune them in so that she could, by means of the word, attend to something rather than the infinite. The infinite, when we attend to it, wholly, is equivalent to nothing. If we get hold of infinity, we're doing that which the Japanese no-mind specialists aim to do. We get hold of nothing instead of something. The reason why we do that is because if we get hold of nothing first and then get hold of something within the nothing, we can see that thing in isolation from accidental associations with other things, because the nothing is no thing, is actually pure conscious power itself. Pure conscious power is no thing, not a thing, not finite, but it is that in which all finites occur. So in this animal which we are, remember we have the palm from which the five spring out as number six, and remember the number in Revelations of man and of the beast is 666. Six means existence. The word existence has the same root as the word for the number six, because it is a wheel. And the wheel, the circle, splits into six parts when you walk around it with the compass that struck the circle. So five senses and common sense make six. And a body with a life force and a mentational process and a logical, powerful, analytic, synthetic process and a volitional interference are five springing out of one, thus constituting a sixfold being, which in that book of Revelation is called the beast. Yes, masochistic tendencies to get large paper clips in the form of a human hand and put them on my nose to see how long I could bear it. I became fed up with it because I could bear it too long. And I found it was a nuisance during meals and things. Or the hand of destiny, I think it was called. Not too bad now, are we, David? No, okay. And I scrubbed the first part of the tape. What are we talking about here? Nothing at all. Thank you. Right. Without the word, we cannot control things in the world, our own volition, our ideas, our actions. We cannot do it without the word. Those of you who have very young babies at home, who are pre-articulate, know that those babies live biologically. They live from within from the life force by a kind of instinctive process, but they do not know what they are doing, and they will not know reflexively what they are doing until they have a sufficient vocabulary to define their actions in relation to the world and in relation to themselves. So if we cannot control things of the world, or our own volition, or our own ideas, or our actions upon the things of the world, without a word, then the word is correctly said to be really all-powerful. It is not just a priestly figure of speech to talk about the all-powerful, creative word. Remember, the word to create comes from a base, kra, which is ark, which means to circumscribe. We live in infinity, but unless we circumscribe our experiences and put labels on them, called words, we cannot control either the elements of the world or of our own being. The other thing we were talking about is personal integration. How can we integrate our own being if in fact we cannot control ourselves without a word, unless we have words to do with the very principles of integration? So let's extend that original triplicity we had of the ontological, the logical, and the moral, and say another thing. The scholars were fond of saying that truth is correspondence between the thought and the thing referred to. We can reduce that to the think and the thing are correspondent when you're telling the truth. And the think of a part of the thing must correspond with the part of the thing. If we're going to say something else more complex and introduce again the will and the word. The will has posited an idea, and the will, when the will does something, initiates it, and the will, if pure, if it's positing one thing only, then the thing that it posits is exactly correspondent with the will. So if we get hold of an idea of a circle, and we define the circle as a form, all the parts of which are equidistant from the center of that form, so that every radius in the circle has the same length. And we define that by an act of will. And because the thing is tautological, that is really, it's a cyclic definition, it cannot be wrong. When the will posits an idea, then there is exact matching, and we can call that the truth of the correspondence of the will and the idea. Now we can all do that. If I say to you, a posit by an act of will, an animal, offer me an animal, any animal will do. Cat? Donkey. Did I get two from the same fellow, or one? What was yours? Figures. So the calendar will take the cat first, because it's got fewer letters. Now, the cat, when we say, think of a cat, do we all get the same idea of a cat? Have we got a cat in general? Or are we thinking of a marmalade cat, or a black cat, or a white cat? Or have we got catness, the very essence of catness? And if we start trying to define the essence of catness, is it something that meows, is terribly self-centered, waves its tail when angry and spits, and goes on tables when told not to, and is exceptionally difficult to train, and was called cat from a word that means fixity of purpose? And we all know more or less what we were referring to in our minds when we said cat. If I said cat and nine tails, the image would change, wouldn't it? Did you see a pussycat with nine tails, or did you see a whip of some kind? Right? So the word has an evocative, that means an outvoicing power. Right? And we all get more or less the same feeling of the essence of catness. Let's have a few images of the essence of catness. I gave a few. Can you tell me anything at all that you say is essential to catness? Slinky. Wise. Concentrated. Yes, actually, the concentration of cats kills more cats on the road than it does dogs, because they concentrate to go from where they are to where they want to go, looking neither to right nor left nor up nor down, and it results many cats are killed. So concentration can be deadly in isolation. Donkey, the word is made of two other words, don and key, where don equals judgment and the key means something you put into a hole to make the door open. And donkey is the key to judgment, because any judgment whatever, and Adam was thrown out of the Garden of Eden for not believing this, is abstractive and trouble creating unless you remember to reposit it back in the hole. What do you think about when you think about donkey? The essence of donkey, not a house trained little donkey or a big donkey on the sands, but donkeyness. What do you get? Stubbornness. Yeah? Anybody who's seen donkeys sitting down and being beaten and not getting up, braying and doing what they want to do, namely sit, until they want to get up. And you can't do anything with a donkey unless the donkey feels like it. The ancients said, therefore, the donkey must be the essence of pure will. They said that the donkey is the animal of the sun, because the donkey is as obstinate as the will. A man convinced against his will is of the same opinion still. Its sexual capacity also was likewise significant to the power of the sun. So we get certain general impressions from all the donkeys we've ever seen, and one thing we find in those donkeys, in all of them regardless of size, is this peculiar capacity for being obstinate. Even when beaten extraordinarily and braying horribly and complaining, they still don't do what they're told. So the word cat allowed us to think about certain qualities, and the word donkey allowed us to think about certain qualities. And since language is written down and put into books, words have been available for about 6,000 years in printed form for anyone who's interested to investigate. The more we know about the essence of words, the more probability we have of being able to control ourselves. Do we believe that? Yay. We believe it. I believe it. I know you all really do believe it. How do I know? Because you spend an awful lot of time selecting words for wheedling, or persuading, or pushing, or frightening. Isn't the word the most economic tool that we've got? Instead of having to thump somebody, we say, would you like a thump? And they think about thumping, yes, that means such a thing. No, thank you. And if we're big enough when we say it, they tend to calm down a bit. So the word is a very mysterious thing. And that brings us to the mysterious word spell. Now, you know the gospel is short for goose spell and God spell. Now, the goose is a symbol of an easily led creature that likes to share when it gets a good thing. And it is also a God spell. Two things. The goose is part of the Christian Trinity, fool, salmon, goose. 3 points in the Celtic Trinity. The fool is said to be the fool for Christ's sake, who deliberately gets a no mind That is, he refuses to be hypnotized by the particular abstractive aspect of a word, and so continuously empties his mind so that he can actually view an infinity of possibilities where a word might trap him into one. When we said cat, we all thought of this sinuous feline feature, but when we said cat or nine tails, then we change the image. But if you are really tied down too tightly to one meaning of a term, you can be manipulated by the term. The term is a tool whereby politicians, advertisers, salesmen manipulate images in the mind. Now, how do you feel if you think that is true? We've got a kind of correspondence here. A will to define an idea. That's precision. A will to define an idea. The idea, if it is not interfered with in the process of being posited by the will, must be exactly what the will defines. So if we say, let us define a triangle, and by a triangle, tri is three and angle is bend, then a triangle has three of those bend bits, three angles. When we define a triangle as a three-sided figure with three angles, we cannot be wrong, because the definitional word, the word in this case triangle, means exactly what we will it to mean. Correspondence between the will and the idea. Now, let's have a look at another correspondence. The scholars have said, let the idea correspond with the thing and call that truth. But let's look at it another way. The will corresponding with the idea, because the will defines exactly what it means by the idea. But supposing I say, all right, triangle. I will now say an equilateral triangle, a three-sided triangle, and then I'm going to try to make one out of a piece of old zinc given to me yesterday. I get a piece of zinc, I get a pair of compasses, I draw a circle, I divide it so there are three points, I put a straight edge on them like this, then I get a saw and I saw it out. I then have a triangle. But is my triangle exactly right? Can it be exactly right? No, it cannot be. Why not? Because my compass is not perfect. Why is it not perfect? When I paid a lot of money for it. I paid a tremendous amount of money for my compass in 1928. It still works, but it wobbled then. And it wobbles today. No matter how much I pay for that compass, I cannot draw a perfect circle with it. Because when I put the point down and turn it, it wears the point out a bit. It may be little, but it wears it out. And the scriber, whether it's a pencil or a piece of metal, also when it scribes that metal, wears out a bit. But does it wear the metal of the zinc out equally? No, it cannot, because that zinc is made of atoms, and the atoms are made of protons, neutrons, electrons, and the electrons are running around very fast and jumping orbits. So what's happening inside the atoms of that zinc when I'm drawing my perfect circle? It doesn't work, does it? Because the electrons are jumping about. If only they'd stay still. But they don't. Because we live in a universe more like Heraclitus than Democritus, in a world of energy flux. So I cannot make my physical thing exactly correspondent with my idea. I can make it with a tolerance of 4 decimals, perhaps. And I can use a micrometer, I can do all kinds of clever tricks. But whatever instrument I use, if the instrument exists in the material world, it must, in the act of being used, wear out a little bit and falsify the form. So although I may will a perfect idea, like a perfect marriage or a perfect party or a perfect political meeting with assured results, no eggs, no tomatoes on the car. Yes, yes, sir, we're glad you came and we see your point of view, and we'll all go back to work. No trouble. Well, in my observation, that is not the world we live in. The world we live in is full of jumping electrons. And your nervous system is made of jumping electrons and protons too. So when you send a message down a nerve, it never gets quite where it's supposed to go. So we have a peculiar non-correspondence between the idea of perfection and the gross material fact. The idea of perfection, as defined by the will, is perfect. And the word perfect means pira, fact. It means rational. It means geometrical. But when we come to apply it in the gross world, its degree of perfection is not that of the pure idea. So we talk about the ideal. The ideal means the idea at work. We put the letter L on the end of the word idea to signify binding it in the manner of that form. Idea is Greek for form. An ideal means how we would say it would be if we could make the idea apply itself in the gross material world. So,
why do you try to be perfect?
Well, he didn't say be perfect and stop the sentence, did he, fella? And is not in the doctrine there God the Father is the absolute will. Yes, the absolute will. Now to be absolute is to be pure, isn't it? Is it? That depends how you define human. Suppose you say to air is human. To be perfectly human by making mistakes all the time. Yeah. What Nietzsche calls human. All too human. Yes? Be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. Now how is the Father in heaven perfect? Like this. He wills an idea. And the idea corresponds exactly with his will. But the moment that that positive idea of the perfect relationship is there, part of the definition is that the defined elements shall be free to follow from within themselves the implications of their own creation. So that when Lucifer, who is an example of an angel, mythically said to be the brightest of all the angels, is created, he is smarter than anyone else. He is lighter, he is brighter, he is more intellectually clear than any other angel. So he is the brightest possible creature. The brightest, the most intelligent creature. Now creature means from create, art, encapsulated. But the moment you encapsulate energy, is there not a bit of a wobble? Yeah? And doesn't the creator who creates it know that there is a bit of a wobble? So that there is a statement, he who judged us is he who made us. He's making us out of energy. And the essence of energy is that it works. And it is sentient. So the moment you encapsulate and sphere energy to make one being a monad, that being is free because there is nothing to make it of other than free spirit equals intelligent power. But the moment you encapsulate it, you have encapsulated a zone of free will. So if it wills to get even brighter than possible, who can stop it? Can anybody stop it? No, because in the very act of encapsulating it, the will of God, the infinite, has been to posit a sphere of intelligent power, sentient power. And that is an individual self, a monad, which is utterly, absolutely self-determined in its encapsulation to be the authority for its own being, and all it does. Now in that sense, Lucifer is made perfect. That is, Pilate, rationally, he is the brightest conceivable being that is encapsulated. Beyond that, there is only the infinite God, about which nothing abstract can be said. So we have the perfection of the idea, but the idea by definition implies circumscription. The D in the word idea tells you that the definition divides it from another thing that has another definition. So if you say the brightest of all angels, you've also said there are other angels less bright, because you can't have anything whatever that you can evaluate without a judgment, implying relativity. There we have it. The will composite the perfect idea, but it cannot make that idea exactly correspondent in the gross world. The gross world is made of power compacted, power spinning. Now the idea of a sphere is that all parts of the periphery of that form shall be equidistant from the centre. And therefore the sun is such a sphere as a concept, and the earth is such a sphere, and all the ancient philosophers thought of the world as a sphere inside which operations occurred, making other spheres. But is the earth a sphere, or is it an oblate spheroid? Why? Because it is turning. And when it turns to throw itself out of the equator, and that pulls the poles in and contracts them, so it looks like a Christmas-type tangerine. Yeah? So it does not correspond exactly with the ideal sphere. The ideal sphere does not and cannot exist in a kinetic world of time and matter. So we have this marvelous thing of perfection of soul, perfection of spirit in idea. But we cannot, no matter what we do, make that thing appear in the gross world of time and matter. So there's one truth, the truth of the idea to the will that posits it. In the world of the ideas, that's called by Plato the noumenal world. And the word noumenon means quite simply a name. You name perfection. And having named it, can you make it in the gross world? No, you can approximate to it for hierarchical purposes. But because of the inertia of time and matter, you cannot make that perfect form that you can define. The sun? No, it's an oblate spheroid. The sun rotates also. It doesn't only rotate on its axis, it also goes round another star and thus flattens itself in its forward motion and drags itself out like a hen drag at the back end, like all moving bodies do. Yeah. Yes. Remember, he's called the Son of Heaven. Yes. And the mystics would say, like Jacob Bremer, the visible sun in the sky is a god for the world of fallen time and matter. That it is good, because without it we would have no energy. It is a step-down transformer from infinity to make it bearable to us to survive under its influence, which is tremendously weakened by its process of self-encapsulation. But the important thing is, we have to be clear, volitional-ideational correspondence can be perfect because we quite simply have the will to define. We merely name the conditions. A triangle shall have three sides, a square shall have four sides. And having said that, there's no argument. It's the end of the game. That is one correspondence, one kind of truth. Now we move on to another one. The idea that we have will to exist, and the word that represents the idea. Now, unless you get an absolute phonetic correspondence, then your idea is not adequately represented by the word. At this point, I call upon my friend Gerhardt, who, of all the people I know here, has taken seriously the idea of the mantra, the sound word, so that when he says a mantra, he says it with tremendous force, and he doesn't mind, and he's not abashed by splitting it up into its component parts. So I might even ask him if he'd come out and demonstrate. Would you do that for me? Yeah. Gerhardt has taken this very seriously. Most of us are too civilized and embarrassed to do this. Luckily, Gerhardt is not totally ruined by civilization. So, will you take for me the word? We'll take the word cat because it's simple. Look at it as three components. The first one is a hard K sound. The middle one is simply a breathing R. Yes? And the terminal one is a T, which is made by putting the tongue against the palate just behind the teeth. Yes? And you make them quite discreet for me and hit them really hard. And I want you to listen to the effect of this on your ears and on your psyche. See how you feel when he takes this simple word, which is, oh, have you seen the cat today? If we lose the power of the mantra when we say, have you ever seen a cat? New to that. I want Gerhardt to say it as he knows how to say it.
Cat! Ah!
And when he made those three sounds, did you get a differential feeling for each one? Yes. But you don't find that so much if I say, I saw a cat in the garden today, do you? Civilization has taken the edge off reality. Would you believe it? Civilization has taken the edge off reality. That is, the edge is the definitional power of created things. It's been ruined by civilization. Now, will you say that same word for me again? Yeah, but I want you to keep the force and separation, but accelerated, so that one follows the other very rapidly. Faster. Now, how did you feel when you had that accelerated form? More creative? Clearer? Yes? When you say that, an accelerated, so it goes faster and faster without losing the clarity. Have you seen that wonderful chorus of the Battle of the Monkeys in the Far East? Yes? What happens emotively when you hear this kind of thing? And how do you get out feel when you actually do that hard? What happens inside you?
It literally makes me want to jump.
It's a very sharpening word, is it not? Very sharpening indeed. Now we'll take the other word, donkey. Now donkey is a D. That's a voiced letter, which would be a T if it were unvoiced. But it is voiced. It's a D, hard, made of the tongue against the palate, but with a humming coming from the vocal cords. An O that means a sphere, an N that means negation, control. And then the hard K again, and then a letter E, which we're going to pronounce A in this case. It might come out a bit posh actually, so don't care. But it is quite correct for that E to be pronounced A, which means life. It is a threefold letter, three bars. The Hebrew letter, hey, the fifth letter of our alphabet, The fifth letter of that Hebrew alphabet, He, means light. And then a Y pronounced Ye, which means an affirmation, an assent to, an assertion. So we're going to have a D or N-K-A, Ye. Right? First slowly, please.
D. O. N. K. E. Y.
And when you do the N, instead of saying N, just put on the N like this. N. Again.
D. O. N. K. E. Y.
Now, when you start accelerating that for me, I want you to watch what happens inside your emotive field. There'll be an idea coming from the letter, but there'll also be an emotive thing coming with the idea. And if you quietly form the same sounds in your mouth and in your mind, you will find arising certain emotive responses, one to each of the forms. You start accelerating now, please. Yeah.
D. O. N. K. E. Y. D. O. N. K. E. Y. D. O. N. K. E. Y. D. O.
Very good, wasn't it? Don't know why you're here. I'm worn out. Now, did you notice that that word donkey, as he accelerated, became a very obstinate kind of word? That n, yes, means no and yes. Now, you have in your throat here a thing, the Adam's apple, which is called the larynx. And most people think it's just called the larynx. You know, it's called the larynx. But it's the larynx. Did somebody say, well, what is that thing sticking out of that neck? And some say, well, let's call it arbitrarily the larynx in midair. I mean, did it happen that way? No. Very intelligent priests said, we are going to name that thing which is the origin of the word with a very mysterious name which means exactly what its function is. It is L-A-R, which is a word for law. L-A-R, law. Those of you who sail know what larboard is and starboard. What's larboard? Which side of the boat is that? The left side of the boat. And the left corresponds with the intellective side, right? And law, therefore, means the law. We'll break it up in a moment, but it means law. And then it goes N, Y. Yes? No, yes. Yes? With a cross, an Andrew cross. Yes? Can you see it? So I was waiting for you, dear. You actually found. You'd rather have it YN. The reason I said NY, because the first word ever spoken by the infinite was no. Because you have to say no to infinity to positive finite, yes. But we'll spell it L-A-R-Y-N-X. Where L-A-R means law, Y means yes, N means no, and the cross means conflict. So the larynx is that organ which tells you the law of yes, no, conflict. Because every time you speak, do you not have to be careful what you say? Whether you will say yes or no? And is there not a conflict necessarily in your mind in case you say the wrong thing? And especially if you're civilized. And the more civilized you are, is there not more and more care about what you say? And if there is more care, are you not more tense? And if you're more tense, are you not nearer to death? There isn't extreme civilization the borderline of death. Yes? There's a funny fellow called Gilgamesh in Babylonia, and his name meant really civilization or getting in a mess in the wheel. And he had a friend, Enkidu, who meant natural man. And through the foolishness of Gilgamesh, his friend, natural man, is killed. And Gilgamesh is so overcome, he goes on a search to find an elixir of life to give to his friend and cause him to be reborn alive. But he fails. It is a Babylonian myth that tells you civilization kills you, because it makes you progressively more and more careful. And the spontaneous living man, the true man, must be killed by civilization. It cannot be that the human race can develop without civilization killing them. And because they have to be killed by civilization, they must also be at some point resurrected. No death, no resurrection. What civilization does for you is inhibit you so hard that you are forced to choose to be free. Before civilization, the baby doesn't know that it's free. It's spontaneously blowing bubbles and doing all kinds of weird things, but it doesn't reflexively know that it is. But by means of civilizing processes imposed on the child, impedances are set up in the organism which force the child into reflexive self-consciousness, progressively, bit by bit, in momentary flashes, and then in longer flashes, and finally in continuous reflection. So the word larynx tells you, in one little word, the law of yes-no conflict. Yes-no conflict. Now the law itself is made lar, L and R. L means to synthesize, to bind, and R means to analyze. The letter A, the original alpha or aleph, in the middle, represents the absolute, and it has polarized itself out in two directions. One towards discrimination, analysis, one towards synthesis, binding together the analyzed elements. So we could write the letter A up there, and then we could write on the one side, I will say the left side, L, the binder, and on the right side, Dexter, the discriminator, and read A polarizes as L, R. So the absolute comes down, and because it is essentially non-discrete itself, because it's pure power, it is always L. You can't break the L, the continuity of power. But you can make it vibrate, and that is the letter R. You can make it, through its vibrational activity, discriminative. So the absolute can appear as a discrete universe of separated forms, but it also holds these forms in relation. So the name of God, A-L, Al, as in Allah, Akbar, that name means God in his indestructible unity. But the other name, A-R, is a base that meant to plow, as in Allah, Arable. That means to cut troughs into that infinite power. So that you have there, in that mysterious word lar, law, a Norse root, you have the instructions about discrimination and simultaneous holding together of the discriminated. Now most of us tend to discriminate and forget to synthesize. We know that the colored peoples in the world like the red-faced so-called white men, those people have the same number of chromosomes as the white men. We have been taught, for certain imperialistic reasons, to discriminate between them. And in the process, we have forgotten the essential chromosomic identity. They can crossbreed, so they must be sufficiently related in essence. They must have the same origin. We have been taught, for imperialistic reasons, to discriminate against certain kinds of things and not to bind them in a big synthesis within the universe of primordial power. And when we do this discrimination and forget to synthesize, then we have social drama. We have peculiar demonstrations in which even the defenders of the peace, the police, are injured. So the larynx is a very peculiar thing, because it is that peculiar non-sphere of being that controls all the other spheres. There is a Hebrew tree of life, a Kabbalistic tree, and that tree is represented as having 10 spheres upon it. And each sphere represents a certain zone of activity of power. But there is one zone corresponding with the larynx which is never drawn in as a circle, but is referred to obliquely as a non-sphere. Why? Because peculiarly it has names for all the other spheres, but it also has negative terms like the term non-sphere. So from the word in the larynx you have a peculiar zone in which you can not only talk about anything, you can also talk about nothing in negative terms. No thing. Infinite, not finite. Illimitable. Ineffable. Unspeakable. And so on. So that peculiar organ there actually goes beyond all definitions of a positive order, because it contains elements called negatives which negate the positives, and yet is meaningful. Because if I say the word ineffable, unspeakable, I'm actually talking about what I can't talk about. But I'm talking about it. And we know that it's true, because we have inside our being something that we cannot voice. You try to express a meaning that you've got. Try as hard as you like. Give me a meaning, any meaning. Who thinks they know something clearly? What is it? Are you racking your brain? Do you know anything whatever clearly beyond argument? Did somebody say God? Is that beyond argument? I thought we'd murdered a few million people about that word, trying to decide what it meant. Can we take God as certain? In your instruction? You said believe, didn't you? You know that the word believe comes from the same root as the word love. So you're really saying that you love the concept of God. And that's what it means. Mm-hmm. Now, is your belief certain? I mean, is it unshakable if I liberate Patrick Moore on you? Is it really? I mean, well, you say you are being almost as foolish as an astrologer. You're certain. Right. Can you define the word certain for me in your usage? Mm-hmm. You said seen. Will you define the word seen for me? what is sure. Are you going in a circle? Does the more in more positive than not sure imply degrees? So are you certain? You see that leading thing, the word? That one. It is possible to destroy faith in the unguarded by boxing them up with terminology. And if they don't know the words are fabrications of the will, not of our individual selves only, but of the absolute, which is a vibratory sentient power. Now you know that sound is alternations of compression, decompression, and that alternating compression, decompression produces geometrical forms. If we put sand on a plate of glass and then bow it so that it makes a sound, the sand shakes and falls onto nodal points and lines, and we have a piece of geometry. And the geometry is related to the vibrational behavior of the plate. So that sound and form are indestructibly together. So then we have to look at two kinds of words. The words of the absolute, that's called the word of God religiously, where the vibratory behavior of the field of power structures the forms of reality in the world. Vibratory behavior of power is the source of all our structures. You see that in the case of the snowflake. There is water freezing in the air. If you put it under a microscope, it's made of little wheels. You can see millions and millions of them. They're all slightly different, but they're all based on the same geometrical fact of the subdivision of a circle, because the very, very field of the atmosphere in which they are condensed and frozen is vibrating and shuffling those little atoms and molecules onto a grid of vibratory power. So the word of the absolute is not arbitrary in man's sense at all. Man can, like Humpty Dumpty, bend a word, misuse a word, misunderstand a word, but the absolute word is identical. It is the absolute word that determines what we call the mantra, the sound structure which represents exactly the form. So we have a correspondence of the will with the idea, which is perfect, if you will so to define it. We have another correspondence of the idea, the form, with the word. If the word is absolute, we call that the divine word, then the correspondence there is also perfect, and we can say that is true. So we've got two kinds of truth: the truth of the will to the idea, the truth of the idea to the word, where the phonetic elements of the word correspond exactly with the form signified by the idea. Then we have another one. The word is used to control a situation. I asked Gerhard if he would pronounce for me three letters of the word cat, separate them out. And he immediately thought of a K and an A and a T and how to do it. And by means of that word, he was able to force action from his vocal apparatus, wasn't he? So when he decided to say that sound, drawn like that, ka, then he put the back of his tongue up against the back of the palate, near the soft palate, pressed it hard, blew, and then whipped it down to ka. And when he wanted to do the T, then he put the tip of his tongue against the palate, just behind the teeth, the ta. And when he wanted to do the R, he simply left the tongue flat in the mouth, and then the breath going through. So there was correspondence then between the word and the deed. The word and the deed. A young man a few years ago said, "I put my money where my mouth is." is going to do a deed exactly correspondent with his word. When the deed exactly matches the declared word, that is another kind of truth. The truth of the correspondence of the intention of the word and the deed based upon it. But there is another one. The deed acting upon the material thing. If I take a chisel and decide to sharpen that chisel and I get a certain kind of stone, I put a bit of oil on it, and I hold it at a certain angle, my deed of sharpening the physical gross chisel will have to be controlled by a word, namely the word that is the name of the necessary angle that the chisel has to make with the surface of the stone. And if I don't know that angle, I might hold it too flat and make an edge that will cut, but it will be so thin it will be gone in a few cuts. And if I make the angle too steep, it might be that I will make it cut, but only with great difficulty, and it will last a very long time because it's blunt. So there is correspondence with deed and the material to which you apply it. There is a thing you start kiddies off in pottery, thumb pots. You give them a bit of clay, say, roll that into a ball, observe the word ball, or sphere, and you go like this to demonstrate it, and the baby does the same thing, and you say, now stick your thumb into it, and it presses the thumb, and there is a nice little hollow, the same shape, more or less, of the thumb, minus a few distortions from wiggling when you put the thumb in. And then you say, that's a thumb pot. And you put it in the kiln and you bake it very hard and you give it to the baby and say, take that home and show your mother you have entered pottery and you have passed A1. You have made a thumb pot and you can put in it, if you like, some water or a flower or anything. There has been a deed correspondent. And the form of the matter has received the form of the deed. So how many kinds of truth have we got? Instead of the simple triplicity of ontological, logical and moral, we have a more complex thing. And we're talking about the integration of a living being. Now a living being has all these different aspects. There is a physical body. There is a will. The will may or may not be acting to form the body. If it has that, it must have been inspired somewhere, either by the Absolute, by God, or by the ancestors, or by the perceptions occurring in itself. It is going to apply its will to the form of that body. But unless it has a word mediating it, what form is it going to make? You could get a big piece of clay and instead of making a thumb pot, you could put your elbow in it. An elbow pot. Once you have put the two terms together, you are able to control the clay in another way. Ashkenazi last night did a very brilliant passage in Shanghai and finished up hitting the last note with his nose. That was a nose note. When I was a small boy, my father used to play piano, and sometimes he put a peg on his nose and used to do the melodic line while he was doing arpeggios like this, banging with his nose. Those are nose notes. Now, the important thing is to remember the word is the mediator. You have a will to do something, but you don't know what to do unless you have a word. And the word must have a significance in two directions. It must refer to a form, index finger, and it must refer to a deed, your ring finger, controlled by the idea. The word reminds you of the idea, and the word allows you to control the parts of the deed that you apply to the gross material. And all of those five, and the relations between them, one, 1, 2, 3, 4, come out of your palm. Palm means actually the place where God substantializes himself. The palm represents the sixth, which is the comprehensive field of intelligent power. Now, how do we feel about this? When we say to ourselves, if we remember the word will, the word intellect, the word word, the word deed, the word recipient matter, and the overlooking of those five, the word overlooker, episcopos, bishop, and we deliberately recall those functions with their appropriate words, then we understand exactly vocare est in vocare. To voice is to invoke, to bring in powers by which we can do things. Now we are talking about integration of the being itself. How do we get that integration? We get it by remembering the word integration. Then the parts should be integrated. We have a physical body, a will, an idea of what we wish to apply to the body, a deed correspondent with the idea, and the word mediating all the way through our mental process. So if I say, what are people pursuing in yoga? And say, nirvana, ultimate peace, heavenly bliss. Right, those are nice words. What does it mean? Does it mean rushing about with no control, banging into things? Or does it mean somehow sitting still? But if you sat still, misunderstanding the word, in one place in this world, a dustman would come and carry you away. Just like a yogi in the high Himalayas today might meditate, but not necessarily in peace, because an intercontinental ballistic missile might come. No, the word still does not mean doing nothing. It does not mean static. It does not mean absence of motion. It means S-T-I-L-L. That's to say, it means self-crucifixion of an individual who knows how to tie himself up in his two aspects. And one of the aspects is the intellective aspect, the other is the volitional aspect. To be still is to be no more than a very, very highly active being on the inside, a being that's so active on the inside that he's really too busy to waste time expressing himself. And yet, mysteriously, to avoid an intercontinental ballistic missile or being carried away by the dustman for looking like a piece of refuse. To avoid that, you have to be able to act physically, emotively, mentationally, comprehensively, volitionally, overlookingly, simultaneously. And yet, remembering the balance of opposites, you balanced all the opposite tendencies inside you, you go back to the lines. The law, where the Absolute has said, discriminate but hold the discriminated parts together. The yes, the why, the no, the N, and the conflict between them. You must be able to say yes, no, simultaneously to every function you have. And if you can do that, so that when you say yes, you mean no as well, and when you say no, you mean yes as well, in every conceivable activity, then you have understood the meaning of the word larynx, and you have also got the capacity for self-integration. And what are you integrating? You are integrating a zone encapsulated, called the individual self, a zone encapsulated of sentient power of the Absolute. So that if you do that, it is legitimate for you to say, at the moment that you do it, I and my Father are not two. Or if you wish, in short form, are one. The word one is interesting, O-N-E. It means a zone negating life. To be one, you have to control yourself. You can't be one without self-control. And if you control yourself so that you become static, you've missed the point. You have to control yourself within the very act, so that what you're doing, you are not doing. This is called way, wu-wei. It is action, not action at all. Because you are doing it, not doing it. Because you are simultaneously doing with it the very contrary of it. You are saying no, yes, to the same thing. Now that's a very simple thing, isn't it, in principle? All you have to do to gain perfect integration of all the aspects of being is to perform everything simultaneously in total absolute self-contradiction. Now there is a preliminary exercise for it. The exercise consists, and this is tremendously important, and people do not, when hearing about it at first, believe it, and they nod, but they don't do it. But if they did it, they would actually find that it's true. If I lift my arm up and then try to press it down, but oppose it. Will you do that with an arm, please? Put an arm out, don't poke somebody in the eye. I want you to press it down with all the force you've got, but I want you to oppose it so that you're pushing it up as well as down. And I want you to see what is happening inside your arm when you do it. I want you, with all the force you've got, try and press it down to the floor, but you're trying to push it up to the sky at the same time. Now don't let go of it. Now try to move it inwards towards the middle line of the body and backwards as well. Yes? And now try to push it away from the body and towards it. Can you feel it going solid? Has it gone warm? Has it gone warm? Yes? I've never complained about cold feet again. Cold feet are a sign of laziness. When you try to move yourself simultaneously in six directions, you are actually integrating every energy in your being. And I'm saying this very, very seriously. When you go to bed at night, and when you get in bed, if you do this self-opposition exercise, and just do it for 10 seconds, not quick seconds, 10 seconds, in which you count for a second, 1, 2, 3, 4. You put the and in so you don't say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Because it's very, very hard work. And what it actually does, because you cannot do this exercise without using your intelligence. So that you're actually integrating intelligence into a physical act. Now in Swedish drill, you don't have to be intelligent at all. All you have to do is use your toes. Notice the difference. I want you to do a Swedish exercise like this. Put your arm up, bring it in. It's called do the hokey cokey, you see. Just go like that. Now, isn't that true that you can do this without self-opposition? Because when you push out, you're out, and when you push in, you're in. You push out and in, out. You could forget about it. But there are people who go about like this, you know. And they get treated. Exercise without self-opposition can never integrate anyone. And I'm telling you very seriously, if you dare to do that exercise for 10 seconds at night when you get into bed, the bed gets warmer. You see, the fellow, the wife gets warmer. In the morning before you get up, do it again. And I guarantee that within the week you will notice a change, not only in your physical body, but in your integrational command over that body. Yeah? Yes, that's right. But you do it all over the body. Yes? Not just one arm. You lie down, yes? This is why I said 10 seconds will do. You lie down in bed, yes. You try to sit up, but you pull yourself back so you don't. Yes? You try to lean to the right and the left. And you try to stretch your feet to the bottom of the bed whilst you're actually pulling them up. Would you like to do that now, just for a little practice? You can do it where you're sitting, if you like. When you sit, I want you to try to move your legs forward from the knees, if you're doing that, and hold them back, and try and lift your arms up and press them down, yes, and your head forward and back, then right and left, and stretch and compress. Now, how's it doing? What's happening to your organism? Tonicity. Tonicity is another word for unity. Yeah? Tone. It means the crucified one. Yes? Yeah? I'd try to spread it over the whole being if I were you, otherwise you'll find you've given yourself a shock enough to do that. You do have to be careful to do it right, you know. Because remember, when you focus on a particular part of your being, you energize that part. And when you're looking for whole integration, as the Greeks used to say, you must pay the same amount of attention to every part, not just the favorite part.
What do you do if you get
stung? Well, the first thing you do the first thing you do with that is not be surprised. And that's why I recommend don't do more than 10 seconds. Yeah. But when you do get it, if you will stretch, you'll pull the muscle out from its cramp. Yeah? The word that you can define of the material fact, of the deed to be done on the fact, the idea that controls the form of the deed on the fact, the will to formulate the idea. And the word is reminding you of the whole thing, including the bishop, the episcopos, the overseer of the whole process.